It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about one Wisconsin man's quest to increase police accountability after the death of his son, and what lessons can be applied to what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri.
First, our next guest is in support of a ballot initiative that would split the state of California into six smaller states. He says doing the same thing with big populous states like Texas, Florida, New York would make for more efficient, accountable government.
Turns out splitting up states is a possibility provided for in the Constitution, although it hasn't been done since the Civil War era.
Michael Lynn joins us now. He's a columnist at Salon and a policy director at the New America Foundation. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with California, which has an actual ballot initiative to split the state into six smaller states. Why do you think this is a good idea for citizens and for government?
Well, if you look at our 50-state system today, there's enormous disproportion between the populations of the largest and the smallest states. By 2025, there could be a 70-to-1 difference between the population of California and of Wyoming. And what that means is that members of the citizens of states with small populations have vastly greater power in the Senate and indirectly in the Electoral College than do citizens of large states like California, Texas, and New York. In fact, it's been calculated that, in theory, 17% of American voters could elect half of the members of the U.S. Senate because of the malapportionment of the United States Senate with two senators for every state.
And you believe that by doing something along these lines would increase accountability and efficiency in the U.S. government. How would that happen?
Well, it would increase accountability because it's much easier for ordinary citizens to have an impact on their state governments if it's a small state, a small population state. I'm not talking about geographic territory, about population. It's easier to meet your governor if you live in Vermont than if you live in Texas or California or New York. So scale makes a difference. If you have a smaller unit, then the price of statewide political marketing campaigns is much lower. And as I point out in my Salon piece, in the early 20th century, John Nance Garner, the Texas politician who was Franklin Roosevelt's first vice president, argued for breaking up Texas precisely for the reason of the cost of statewide Texas political campaigns.
Now, there are people, including Tea Party affiliates, who see the federal government as bloated and riddled with redundancies, and they'd like to see more power coming from the state government. So if you split the states, don't you weaken everything but the federal government?
Well, you have to remember we have three levels of government. There's the local, that is cities and counties, and then above that there's the states, and above that there's the federal government. And as I argued in my Salon piece, why would any rational person prefer a state government, particularly in a very large populous state, to the city government? If you look at K-12 systems, for example, now they're funded about half by the state and about halfway by the local community. But there's a rebellion against Common Core standards being imposed by the federal government and to some extent by state governments. People like local control. A lot of infrastructure is local. A lot of utilities are within the metro area or the county. So the real question is, what exactly do state capitals do that are not done better either by cities and counties or by the federal government? So if you had, and remember, most Americans now live within a fairly limited number of major metro areas. So it's just a question of why you aggregate some metro areas inside of the borders of a very populous state as opposed to letting these major metro areas have more influence within a smaller state.
But if you're, sort of busting down the state government and putting the priority on your local government, a smaller unit of government, doesn't the very fact that it's smaller give it less power?
Well, not necessarily. The main issue with small governments is resources. And so I argue that if you're going to have more states and smaller states, it would be best to accompany that with some kind of revenue sharing. But that's best done at the federal level anyway, not within the state level. So it is the case that, let's say, within a state like California, The small towns may benefit from taxing Los Angeles and San Francisco and redistributing some of the revenue. But if you want to have a revenue sharing system, it would be much better to do it on a continental basis, not just within state borders.
I'm a little hung up on the practicality of this proposal in that if say we split California into five smaller states, doesn't that create five more states within the United States? Five more stars on the flag, five more state capitals. Are we really getting rid of state government, or are we just increasing, multiplying the amount of state government?
Well, arguably, you would have state government that's closer to the people and less likely to be captured by big interest groups, or whether they're labor unions on the left or corporate interests on the right. You know, one of the problems is with particularly with large states. I'm a Texan myself, and I worked in the Texas state government. You know, within a very large populous state, the state government itself is kind of like a miniature federal government. It's very remote from ordinary citizens. It's very difficult for them to monitor it compared to their local city politics. So, you know, I think experience shows that smaller states are more transparent and more accountable than these enormous states which have populations as big as many countries in the world, like Texas and California and Florida and New York.
What does the Constitution have to say about this?
Well, it actually allows state borders to be redrawn. Article 4, Section 3, Clause 1, if you want to look it up, says new states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state formed by junction of two or more states or parts of states, without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of Congress. So there are two very difficult bars you have to pass. One is, if you're going to subdivide a state, the state legislature or the state government has to approve. The other is that Congress has to approve as well. And in that case, you have the jealousy of existing states don't want their power in the Senate diluted by having more senators come to the Senate. So, you know, it's more of a thought experiment than a practical proposal. But nevertheless, the case is, if you look in the long run, if you get to the point where California has, let's say, 80 million people, and, you know, some of these small western states like Wyoming have 500,000 people, and each is represented by two senators, you do have to wonder what will happen. And if the majority of the American population, which lives now in a fairly small number of populous states, think that essentially rural, underpopulated states are thwarting what they want to get through Congress, and arguably that's already a pattern, then there's going to be more pressure for presidents to simply circumvent Congress and to govern by decree. And to some extent, you could argue we see this already with both the support and the opposition to President Obama's plan to try to do things by executive order because of stagnation in the Congress. So I think there is a real serious threat to democracy that if we don't have a more equally apportioned Senate, then we're going to move towards a kind of Latin American plebiscitary presidential system where you have small population states are just blocking things that the overwhelming majority of Americans want, and that to get around this, the president, who is elected by this large popular majority, will simply circumvent Congress and claim executive authority to do things that can't be done by legislation.
If it's easier to get a meeting with a governor in a smaller state, isn't it then therefore easier for a lobbyist to do it as well?
No, remember, the lobbyists get their access mainly because of the high price of political advertising campaigns. And the larger the market, the larger the political market of a state, the more expensive it is to run for statewide office. So you will always have lobbying in one form or another. But that particular incentive of corruption, the need to raise millions of dollars to compete in a geographically enormous political advertising market, you can reduce somewhat.
We're talking about a proposal to split up big populous states to make smaller statelets. Michael Lind is the policy director at the New America Foundation. He wrote about this idea in Salon.
And we want to know what you think. Does it make sense to split up big, high population states? Would it make it easier for people to influence politics and government? You can let us know your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about an idea to split up big population-rich states and make smaller statelets. Our guest says it's a thought experiment, but if it happened, it could make government more accountable, more democratic, and more efficient. Michael Lind is the policy director at the New America Foundation. He wrote about this idea in Salon.
And we want to know what you think. What about Wisconsin? Does it deserve its two senators? Is Wisconsin big enough to keep them? And do you think that larger states should be split apart in this way? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's take a call from Rob in Appleton. Hi, Rob.
Hello. I'd just like to know what your speaker thinks about the fact that it's kind of just another form of gerrymandering in which we'll break up the states and take the power away from the smaller states. The compromise that happened when the Founding Fathers was done for a reason, to split the populous states and then give everybody an equal voice to start with. And I'll take my comments up here.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, I'm glad your caller raised the Founding Fathers. Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, Madison was known as the father of the Constitution, they actually opposed this compromise that gave the small states an equal number of senators with the large states. So the disproportion in population was not as great then as it is now. But if you read the Federalist Papers, which are arguing for the adoption of the Constitution, in Federalist Number 2, Hamilton says, well, you should vote to ratify the Constitution, even though this compromise is terrible. And Hamilton writes, the right of equal suffrage among the states is another exceptionable part of the Confederation. Every idea of proportion and every rule of fair representation conspire to condemn a principle which gives to Rhode Island an equal weight in the scale of power with Massachusetts or Connecticut or New York. And writing at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, Hamilton predicted that eventually the large state populations would rebel against the small states. He says, quote, the larger states would after a while revolt from the idea of receiving the law from the smaller. So that was in 1788-89. The larger states have yet to revolt. But this was controversial even among the authors of the Federalist Papers, who argued the Constitution was good, but the equal representation of the states was a mistake.
Well, we appreciate that call. We're going to go next to Audrey in Eau Claire. Hi, Audrey.
Hello. I was just thinking that this system was created before the Internet, and I do online banking. I think we should start phasing out Congress and give everyone a vote, one vote for what they want to happen, instead of having all these lobbyists involved, and let the Congress become functional society in some other way.
Okay, Audrey's got some really big ideas, getting rid of Congress, going to, you know, a single vote system for everybody. Is that an extension of this idea, Michael?
Well, no, this idea works within the existing constitutional system, and the subdivision of the states does not require any amendment of the basic constitutional structure. It's just multiplying the units. You know, your caller is quite within her rights to think about 21st and 22nd century alternatives to this very territorially based system of representative democracy that we have and that other democracies have today, though.
You mentioned, a bit of a disagreement between the founding fathers of our Constitution and those who have written the Federalist Papers. And I'm wondering, though, if the current setup of the government does address your concerns. You had mentioned the malapportioned Senate, having two senators from every single state, not being a fair representation of the larger states versus the smaller. But isn't that what the House of Representatives is for?
Well, not according to Hamilton in the Federalist Papers. That is, even the Senate should more or less reflect population. The difference was the scale of the constituencies. So the idea was not that the Senate should represent you know, essentially acres instead of people. What the basic idea was that the House of Representatives would have very, very small districts that are very close to the people. And by the way, in 1789, in the first Congress, the districts were much smaller than they are today. And then the statewide districts in America, which then had a much smaller population, would be somewhat bigger. So the idea was, and in the bigger districts, it was thought that having more of a variety of interests would tend to moderate things. So that particular special interests could be reflected in the House. But the Senate would tend to be more moderate because they had a larger, more diverse constituency, as did the president. And that would continue to exist even if you had so much smaller states.
I want to look at another aspect of this, Michael. You also say that splitting up big populous states would let governments and regions, states essentially, form around people who have things in common. And you give Austin, Texas as an example. It could be.
Well, I'm a native of Austin.
There you go. It could be, what did you call it, Centex? Central Texas, the state there. But America's not really founded on the idea of letting birds of a feather flock together. It's, you know, a melting pot, or it's at least a tossed salad. Wouldn't this idea just sort of increase local tribalism?
Well, it might, but on the other hand, if you look at what goes on in state governments now, you have essentially most states, and I'm sure Wisconsin is like this, you have one or two large metro areas. The very big states like Texas and California have three or four. Then you have small towns and rural areas. And the constant battle, and it's a battle of values as well as of interests, is between the rural areas and the big cities. And so it's not clear to me, having been in state politics in my youth, that the result from the rural people nullifying the urbanites and the urbanites thwarting what the rural people want, that compromise is necessarily better than what you would get if you had somewhat more homogeneous system.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Don in Sparta. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I basically agree with your guest. I think it's a good idea, but the idea that each state having two senators is unfair, it's the best attempt to compromise a situation whereby if all representation was by population, the small states would never get their interests carried out. They would always be outvoted and outweighed. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Don.
Well, that's the basic issue. Do states, as states, actually have interests distinct from their people? Or is the conservative evangelical Protestant who happens to live in a liberal state like California, does that person really have more in common with the conservative evangelical Protestant in Wyoming? So it's not clear to me that there actually is anything which a state, you know, one of these kind of arbitrary geographical units, that these correspond to actual populations. And if you look at most states, they're very deeply divided along fairly similar demographic lines. As I said, there's the urban versus suburban and rural divide. There are racial divides, as we've seen tragically, you know, in the last week or so. And it's not clear that a sense of common state identity, even in my native state of Texas, where there's a strong sense of Texan identity, actually corresponds to a real human community.
Well, there's the matter of identity and culture and community, but then there's also resources, financial resources. What happens then to these smaller states or those that are comprised mostly of rural residents and populations? Where does their funding come from for things like schools and roads?
Well, that's why I propose federal revenue sharing. And also going all the way back to the Progressive Era and the New Deal, the compromise that we have struck between the needs for financing, particularly rural Midwestern and Southern states, and the free market, is to have net federal institutions that are regionally organized. So, you know, there are the 12 Federal Reserve Banks. There are there's the Farm Credit System, which is based on regional multi-state credit institutions. So that is a challenge But we actually have 70 or 80, 90 years of dealing with it. And it was decided in the 20th century that there is a kind of nice medium for credit purposes of local business credit and farm credit and housing credit. And the medium is not to have 50 separate public banks and investment institutions, and not one single one in Washington or New York, but to have regional ones. And there are also many, many, many examples of regional interstate compacts where states which share a common river or a common border or a common harbor collaborate in order to have environmental standards or to maintain commercial infrastructure.
And, Michael, we have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Lind is a columnist at Salon and a policy director at the New America Foundation. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Rob Farid. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, from inches to miles, we'll look at the unique origins of American measurement systems and why the USA never went metric despite a big push in the 1970s.
First, in the aftermath of the shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, there's been considerable outrage directed at the officer implicated in the shooting. For our next guest, the story hits close to home. 10 years ago, Michael Bell's 21-year-old son was shot and killed outside of his home in Kenosha.
Since then, Bell has pushed for Wisconsin to pass a law requiring an outside agency to conduct investigations in police-related deaths, a law that ultimately passed in the last legislative session. He says our country is simply not paying enough attention to the lack of accountability in police departments and the way it affects all of us, regardless of race or ethnicity.
Michael Bell joins us now. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force and just wrote a piece for Politico magazine called What I Did After Police Killed My Son. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, as you watch the story unfold in Ferguson after the police shooting of teenager Michael Brown, what's going through your mind?
Well, a lot of things have gone through my mind. I know what the family feels like, and being a retired Air Force officer, I in many ways feel I know what the law enforcement people must be going through. It's very hectic. For the family, though, they're going through some very tragic moments. The best way I can describe it is it felt like a car fell on me. I mean, to get a phone call that your son is shot. I was upset, too, when they released the autopsy photos, or not photos, but drawings, because I did notice that one or two of the shots were in the head. And in my own son's case, an officer took a gun and placed it directly to my son's head and shot him in front of his mother and sister. And very, very tragic for our whole family. So I carried all those emotions with me when I watched the mom on TV over the last day or two.
Hmm. And it's been 10 years since your son was shot and killed, but it still sounds like it's fresh to you.
Well, you know, we've been fighting for this for a long time, and our family has done a lot of work with counselors and so forth. But you can't fight this effort and do the things that we did by changing laws and so forth without keeping that wound a little bit open.
You've written that there's good reason to think that, quote, many of these unjustifiable homicides by police across the country are racially motivated, but there's a lot more going on here. What's the big picture as you see it?
Well, you know, as an Air Force officer, as a professional, I couldn't come out in the community until I looked at all the different problems that were out there in the nation. And we took a look at all the civilian review boards and so forth, and I brought in a researcher, and I go, how many shootings are really going on? And when we started looking at things, we could not find, since 1885, an unjustified ruling by a police and fire commission, an inquest, or a police department related to any fatal shooting in the state of Wisconsin, 129 years. And in 2005, we found that there was a shooting in Milwaukee. The department ruled it justified. An inquest jury ruled it justified, but additional information was brought in by citizens, and the DA ended up charging the person. So to me, the problem is a culture issue where accountability is at stake.
What happened to your son, Michael?
My son came home from a night out with friends. To make a long story short, he pulled up in front of his house. An officer met him there. The officers made some false accusations. My son was like, no way, I didn't do that. The officer tased my son. My son started receiving some physical confrontations. My son ran to the back. He confronted the officer back. And then Michael's mother and his sister came out. They heard commotion. My son was bent over a car. An officer was holding him, and an officer came up and placed a gun to my son's head and fired a fatal shot in front of his mother and sister. We ended up having to hire an investigator, and our investigator uncovered that an officer who claimed that my son had his gun had actually hooked his gun on a broken car mirror. The police department had conducted a review. They had cleared themselves in as soon as 48 hours, and they hadn't even talked to some of the witnesses that were there. There were five eyewitnesses. It was under a large floodlight in a garage, and that's why I said that if a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy can be shot under a spotlight with five eyewitnesses, and his father is a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel who flew three wars for his country, and we cannot get accountability, then Joe the plumber and Javier the roofer are going to have the same problem that we've had.
Hmm. Well, you write that it took 6 years to get your wrongful death lawsuit settled. Your family eventually received $1.75 million, and you put that back into police accountability to advocate for that. How did you go about doing that?
Well, the first thing I did is we took out additional advertising in the beginning. We wanted to call out what was going on in Kenosha, and in the beginning, district attorney was running for judge, and if you actually go to the michaelbell.info website, you can see there's a link there that says that this district attorney was being endorsed by every police agency in the county as he was actually reviewing another police-related shooting. And so after he lost his election, he decided to honor the police officers with meritorious service awards. So we ended up taking out ads in the Sun-Times, Chicago Sun-Times, New York Times, and so forth. But when the settlement occurred, we refused to accept a non-disclosure. It was always my intent to tell Michael's story, and I wasn't going to be paid off with a paltry sum of money like that, and because a lot of it went to the attorney, and not be able to share my son's story, so I refused a non-disclosure. The mayor of the city of Kenosha allowed that to happen, and therefore our documents weren't sealed. We ended up using those funds to take out billboards, TV ads, and so forth, and we helped a number of other families who have lost loved ones in the state of Wisconsin. You have to remember that this is just not a Michael Bell effort or a Michael Bell family effort. This is a team. We have fantastic individuals who have been creative, and our whole team has never once thrown a Molotov cocktail. We actually got it done with kindness and respect and good creativity and hard work.
Now, you write that initially, after your son was killed, you told your wife and your daughter to be patient, that investigations took a while to unfold. But eventually you realized that this investigation was not going to be anything that had the kind of integrity you were looking for. You dug deeper. You discovered a problem statewide in Wisconsin where an officer had never been found culpable in years and years, decades and decades. Is this just a problem in Wisconsin? How widespread do you think this is?
I think it's widespread. I think it happens across the nation. And some of the hot spots, Eugene, Oregon, Chandler, Arizona, San Diego, California, those people have actually got to the point where they actually do bring in outside investigators. But Wisconsin is the first one that ever mandated all police-involved shootings in the state of Wisconsin or deaths be reviewed by an outside agency. The biggest reason I urge caution was because of the fact that I, as an Air Force officer, knew how mishap investigations were conducted. Typically, a weapon system was lost, lives were lost, and the United States Air Force brought in an investigative team to look at every detail and say, what really happened here and what could we do to make sure that this doesn't happen again? And that's why I thought if the police agencies reviewed each death like that, then police-related deaths would be on an all-time low.
Well, as you said, you did succeed in your quest, at least here in Wisconsin. We're the first state to pass a law requiring an outside agency to investigate deaths in police custody. Is it enough for you? How far do you want to take this?
Well, originally our bill asked for three parts. A lot of things that are happening out there, nobody has a solution. We have a solution. Our bill had three parts. Make sure that the police officer who has the right to take a life was in a clear frame of mind to either pull the trigger or wield the baton. Make sure that they weren't under the influence of alcohol or some type of painkiller or something like that, because that's what happens in a cockpit and that's what happens in a trucking accident. The second thing we asked for was an outside investigation. A police department should not review itself and clear itself of wrongdoing. Bring in outside professionals, allow them to look at it and let them make a determination, because the data can be corrupted when the department conducts its own investigation. And the last thing that we asked for was an independent review of that by law professionals, not just law enforcement. Take the finest people out there, retired judges, retired DA, criminal justice professors, and law enforcement, put them on a panel and allow them to look at it and make sure that this shooting was valid. And if it wasn't, what can we do to make sure that it doesn't happen again? That's what it needs to go. And that's what we tried to do in Wisconsin. We only got part two. And we're going to go back for parts one and three later on. But I think that if what was going on in Missouri had been under this outside investigation, the distrust that is occurring with law enforcement right now would not occur, and therefore the riots may not be happening.
So is your wish then that this legislation in all parts, not just the first two, but everything you outline there, be a blueprint for the rest of the country?
If you go into the article that I wrote in Political, and if you go there, we actually have the national ad that we took out in USA Today. And right down in the bottom it says, this can be a national model. Wisconsin could be a national model for the rest of the nation.
Now that you've got the spotlight right now, people are turning to you. You've got this perspective based on what your own family has been through. What is the message you want to send to the American public right now?
Number one, be patient with Ferguson, okay? Like military members, law enforcement are many times our heroes. And I'm telling you right now, we just went through the second anniversary of the Sikh shooting in Oak Creek, and Lieutenant Murphy took a number of bullets for people. You can go back up to Green Bay, where a state trooper named Les Bolt got out of his car, sprinted up, and grabbed a woman who was jumping off a bridge to commit suicide. They're many times our hero, okay? But right now, be patient with Ferguson. Allow the facts to happen. But we do wonder that if there wasn't a national attention on this, what would have occurred? Would there have been a truthful investigation down in Ferguson if the national attention wasn't there? That's the message we'd like to send out.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
Michael Bell is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. We've got a link to his piece, What I Did After Police Killed My Son, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, ask anyone who has recently moved to the United States, and they'll tell you, our systems of measurement don't seem to make any sense. After all, why are we bothering with inches and feet when centimeters and meters seem to work just fine everywhere else?
But how did we get to this point in the first place? Our next guest took a closer look at the origins of various measurement systems to see how they evolved.
Joining us now is John Bemelmans Marciano. He's an author and illustrator, and his new book is Whatever Happened to the Metric System, How America Kept Its Feet. John, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Well, from an outsider's perspective, our measurement system in the United States might seem bizarre. For us, though, for us who have grown up here in the United States, they just seem to click. Why did the U.S. end up with its own set of measurements while most of the world went with the metric system?
Well, it's really a question of, basically everybody else in the world had a system of measurement, originally extremely similar to ours. The change really started happening around the time, shortly after our revolution, when we adopted the U.S. dollar, which amazingly was the first truly decimal system of measurement that was ever created and used by a nation. It was devised mostly by Thomas Jefferson, and he actually had a plan for taking our measures to be all across the board completely decimal. At that time, though, this is the time of the French Revolution, there was invented the metric system, and Jefferson actually wanted America to consider what they were taking up.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us more about that. For a while, it seemed we were poised to adopt it, and then it never came to pass. What took us off the rails?
Well, we had actually flirted with the metric system pretty heavily. I mean, even George Washington had kept asking the Congress to look at it, but it disappeared from Europe and only really started to make any headway anywhere in around the 1840s. America, looked at it then and pretty steadily looked at it right up until the First World War, then it utterly disappeared from the American consciousness and kind of reared its head again in the 1860s. I'm sorry, in the 1960s. In 1975, Gerald Ford passed the Metric Act that was supposed to take us metric, and there was a huge push to do so, but it just never took.
Mm-hmm. Were there ever any sort of geopolitical reasons for that? You mentioned that it was on our minds up until about World War One or something. Was there any reason that we would want to, for example, distance ourselves from the European way?
Well, the metric system was kind of sweeping the world in the first part of the 20th century. And then with the onset of the Great Depression, kind of all nations retreated into, into nationalism. Internationalism was on the downswing. So places like Japan that were converting to metric actually abandoned the program. When it really took hold worldwide was in the 1950s. Most of the English-speaking world was on either the customary system of measures, which is what we use, or on the British imperial system. The real push for us actually came when the British decided to adopt the metric system, which they had really resisted, but it actually became a condition of their joining the European community.
Talk a bit about the origins of the metric system itself and how, centimeters and millimeters and those units became really the core of the system itself.
Well, the idea was actually that the world, the circumference of the Earth, one meridian, was divided into 40 million parts, and that 40 millionth part of the Earth was 1 meter. And then essentially everything else was slotted in decimally. So a hundredth was centimeter and a millimeter and so on. So it was this idea of connecting the measurement system to the Earth. One cubic decimeter of water was the kilogram, and the liter was also connected. So it was this idea of this really comprehensive system of measurement.
And you had mentioned earlier Thomas Jefferson's role in developing our currency and everything. Draw the link for us, though, between the metric system itself and dollars and cents.
Well, it was this idea that had come up during the Enlightenment, during the middle of the 17th century, where decimal, it seems almost impossible for us to imagine, but the decimal point was only, decimal fractions, the decimal point was only invented in the 16th century, and it really didn't catch on at all until the 17th century. And even at that time, it was only used by the elite of the elites. It was really only around the time of the Revolution that it became right up there with literacy. So decimal fractions was a really new idea. If you think about it, they're actually very artificial creation. If you imagine trying to cut a pizza into 10 pieces, it's pretty hard. If you wanted to, for instance, one of the most typical things that a person would do when they were shopping would be to buy cloth. So if you wanted to buy a small portion of cloth, you would buy something like an eighth of a yard. And the way this would be measured out would be they would fold the yard of cloth into halves, into quarters, and then into eighths, and they would cut it from there. When the metric system was first introduced, that eighth of a yard became 0.125 meters, which was one-tenth plus two-hundredths plus five-thousandths. It was an almost incomprehensible amount of math for people who were really not used to, forget about decimal points, they weren't even really used to multiplication or division. So it was really only when people started getting decent math skills in the middle of the 19th century that something like the metric system was even possible.
Mm-hmm. And we also differ from the world, we in America, with temperatures. And while the rest of the world is measuring the temperature in Celsius, we're in degrees Fahrenheit. How did we end up with the Fahrenheit system?
Well, this is one of the most interesting ones for me, because where you can make an argument that there's a lot more sense in dividing, the meter into hundredths and thousandths than it is dividing the yard and the foot into, the yard into thirds and the foot into twelfths. Both scales are actually decimal. I mean, 100 degrees is 100 degrees no matter, you know, which scale you use. The fact of the matter is that the Celsius scale, whatever you choose for the temperature of freezing water or boiling water, is actually quite arbitrary. There's nothing that says a temperature scale needs to be based on that. What the Celsius scale, what the Fahrenheit scale's weakness is actually that it has negative numbers. It really plays havoc with doing any sort of calculations, scientific calculations. Mm-hmm. And the Celsius scale really just made that problem worse. So even in the actually officially sanctioned measures of science, the SI system of measurement, Celsius is only a secondary measure. The real scale that scientists use is Kelvin, which is based on absolute zero.
Right. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us today. We have so much more to delve into, but we'll have to check it out in your book. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks a lot.
John Bemelman's Marciano is an author and illustrator, and his new book is Whatever Happened to the Metric System, How America Kept Its Feet.